Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for spring semester 2026. Today, foundations of finance. A couple of minor issues before we begin. The square cap, I will get that straightened up over the weekend and we'll begin attendance next week. It's just turned into something of a mess. But you will, if you have not gotten an invitation, you will get one. And if you already have registered in square cap, you can ignore the invitation that comes to you. Let me go on here. Your podcasts of the lectures are now up and running fully. So if you are wanting to listen to podcasts, the lecture afterwards, you will be section two. So you'll see that lecture one for both of your sections is up already. And since lecture two was yesterday, that class is up. And yours will be up within a few hours. Usually I get it up for you who are in this section. And all you have to do is you can click here and it will play, or if you want to just run the player, the good part about the player is that you can actually download in the player. Or if you want to, you can go over to Apple iTunes, clicking there, and as you can see, it's already aggregated the first two lectures, Monday and Tuesday, and the lecture yesterday, Wednesday. It picks it up within minutes and gets it up in Apple iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as they call them nowadays. But the lectures are professionally produced, so they add to Apple's standards, at least what used to be their standards. So all you have to do is play the player. Like I put it this way because there are a few times, there's a few computers, operating systems that can't run the player. I don't know why, but it's an HTML5 player. It should work. But I leave this in case the player doesn't show for you, but it should. And then you just play it and it'll play the podcast for you. Give me a second here. Well, looks like it's not going to play today here in the auditorium. We've still got problems from the flooding, but it will play if you... Nope, it's not playing in the player either. So apparently it's the sound system in here is shot for the day. But yeah, you just click on it, play, make sure that you're in your section, and you'll be fine. And as I had told you last time, you can go to other... semesters and listen to the entirety of the lectures there. I've got tired of repeating them, but there are years and years of previous lectures here. And at the bottom, if you want to see the work that I do as a professional artist, you can go clear to the bottom and see some of my exhibition work. And again, this is for you. You don't have to listen to the podcast. You can just rely on notes. A caution I should make to you is that the in-class quizzes are in Respondus. Now make sure that you take that practice quiz and so that you know that your Respondus is actually working for you, that you can actually access the quiz. It's a practice quiz over here. What was I thinking? But in the Respondus, you on in-class quizzes, you can use your notes for the quizzes. The problem is the Respondus will block you from if you are trying to get to notes that you have on a computer keyboard, on a computer. So if you are typing your notes up, make sure that you have them printed out before a quiz. And by the way, I will have a surprise quiz for you next week. So please be surprised by it, okay? But you do have to have physical notes because you can't access anything outside of the Respondus browser. And make sure that you're taking these quizzes on a laptop because it won't work if you're trying to do it on a phone. It's not going to happen. Respondents doesn't work that way. So just be sure that you've got written notes or you print your notes. That's all you have to do. Other than that, we're going to have a look at the numbers. And this will be one of those days where I give an extended exposure to this part of the class. Most days it'll be about 15 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. Today it will be longer because I will be giving you a lot of information, and it will be, at first, it will be like a blur to you. But as the days go on, you'll see more and more of the actual information and understand what it's saying to you. And this is a very simple kind of screen, but it gives you the sense of what you should be able to do if you want to have control of your own decision making with respect to investments. And it goes beyond investments, because the world out there that you will be walking into, it will be probably a corporate world, most likely a public company. So a lot of its information is in the price and other information you see here. And so it gives you a better idea of what kind of a company you're applying to. Is this a company on the rise, or is this a company that is declining? What does the world's best and minds think in terms of this as an investment opportunity? And you can look at it from, what does this tell me about employment opportunity, or the something along those lines? So there's more than just investment involved in this. Now, as I have said, and I said this in the last lecture, and I'll go through this again for you to some extent, is that when we look at markets, the first thing is, I'll point out that we are looking first at financial markets. And then in a few minutes, we will look at physical markets. And we can divide the world of finance into, I was wondering why I was so blurry. We can divide the world of finance into these two. We'll divide it up a lot of different ways. But financial assets, stocks, and bonds. Physical assets, gold, silver, oil, hog bellies, wheat. So these are two distinct markets. First, we look at the financial markets. Now, in the financial markets, we can talk about what those numbers are talking about. We have exchanges. Now, in Europe, they are called bourses. These are platforms where literally, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of stocks are traded. They are, in some cases, vast. The classic is the New York Stock Exchange. It is enormous, and it is very big companies are on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, there is also, this is a physical platform where everyone is yelling at everyone, buy, sell, papers flying everywhere, and all that. And then you have another one that is well known here in the United States, the NASDAQ. This is companies that are actually quite small, or relatively speaking, small cap, as we say. Small cap companies, very risky, well, not very, always very risky, but riskier, small, aggressive. They rise fast, they fall fast, and all this kind of stuff. Now, there are other, this is in the United States. There are bourses all over the world. There's every major capital has an exchange. Tokyo, Hong Kong, you've got Berlin, you've got Paris, you've got Barcelona? I don't know. But there, London, they're all over the place, these exchanges are. And even in the United States, this is just a side point, there are regional exchanges like the Philadelphia Exchange, PhillyX, and other ones too. So it's lots of these around. Now, on the other hand, you also have indexes. Now, an index is a sampling from the exchange. It gives you sort of like a picture of the whole exchange without trying to do the average and aggregate the entire thing. So, for example, you might see in the United States, the S&P, well, the first one would be the Dow 30. Just 30 huge companies. So when you look at this average, you're looking at what is happening, what information is being assessed at the very largest scale of the economy. These oligopolies are in there. It used to be called the Dow Industrials because it was all industrial companies. But as our economy's texture has changed, most of those companies are entertainment or service related. I think the originators of the Dow Industrial 30 would turn over in their graves if they knew that Disney was now in the Dow 30. But, and then there is the S&P 500. These are the 500 enormous companies. Generally speaking, they are as what you might have heard in your microeconomics course. These are monopolistic competitors. They have monopoly power over their product, over products in the short run, but they drift into more perfect competition in the long run. These are big, big companies. Those 500 companies are, when we see that index, that is measuring about 65 to 70% of the entire world's value in those 500 companies. And then you also have in other indexes, and I'm going to go into these now. But the one thing is, if you see numbers or a letter after a listing, that means it is an index. So the first one we would look at here on this screens up here, you would be looking at the Nikkei 225. So we're going to start the world's day over on the other side of the world, where that was last night to us, through the night. That was morning and afternoon over in Asia. And we see that the first one we want to look at is Nikkei 225. That's 225 stocks on the Tokyo Exchange. These are big companies, and they are representative of what happened on the entire exchange. As you can see, that was green. So if it's green, it means it was higher at the end than it was at the beginning. And so when we have a higher day, what do we call that? Do you remember what kind of a day that is? Bull. You say bull. And that was actually a very, where the heck did it go? Oh, that 1.30%. That's a strong bull day. Now, that's not wildly great, but that is a pretty darn good day. Anything above like 0.75%, that's a decent day. And the Nikkei just roared upward. Notice that it has a characteristic pattern. And I finally got some good explanations of why that is. But notice that the Nikkei, most of its action happened at the opening bell. It popped. And I'll get into that later. But it has to do with this aftermarket and pre-market activity. And when the bell opens, in this case, there were more buys and sells on the 225, and so it jumped at the opening. And then it kind of just sort of drifted from there. It had a little bit of a dip and then a rise there again. But a lot of times on the Tokyo Exchange, a lot of the action happens in the aftermarket simply because they're trading on information from places in the rest of the world that are on a different clock than they are. Now, coming down here, the Hang Seng. Hang Seng was up too. That's Hong Kong. And that, you notice, that's an exchange. There's no number after. That's an exchange. So it was up. China was up 0.8%. Decent day. Darn decent day. And you can also say, well, we can also see Australia, which is technically in that Asian band of time zones, it was actually kind of off. There was a bearish day. It wasn't awful at all. Like I said, anything plus or minus 0.25% or smaller isn't very spectacular at all. And then we come, the sun came over the sky in Asia, and then it began to set, and it was rising in Europe. And then we see these here. This is the European tier of exchanges waking up. The CAC 40, 40 stocks on the Paris exchange. Sample of the all of the stocks. They take 40 of them and say this is sort of like representative of what happened to the whole on the whole exchange. And these are, and notice that that just tailed out all through the day. Now that would mean not that there was one piece of information that dragged through the day, because once a piece of information is absorbed, and it's absorbed within milliseconds or seconds at the worst, this would be the result of continuing negative pressure, and that pressure was coming from information, pushing it down and down and down. So in this case, there was no relenting. This thing just kept sliding. It wasn't awful. I mean, a little more than 0.5% down, but still it was decidedly bearish in Paris. Now DAX P, that's Berlin. It too was down. So we're kind of seeing a little bit of a pattern here. Europe had more bearish, some bearish sentiment around the continent. And then Euronext is a sampling of stocks from all the different exchanges around Europe. So it's sort of more representative of all of Europe. And that guy was down a little bit, not much. Again, you know, it's definitely bearish. And looking at this pattern, you see all that red, that's telling you, okay, it was definitely a bearish day. Not terribly bearish, but it was bearish. However, when we get out of Europe and we get to Great Britain, the FTSE, Financial Times, that's 100 stocks on the London Exchange, that was up a tiny bit. You notice that it had been struggling. The bears had been mildly in control all through the day. See that spark chart there? They'd been in control through the day, but then there was a bullish surge that made it, at by the end, finish up a little bit. Nothing spectacular at all. But now we come over here. The sun was setting in Europe and running across the Atlantic, and then it opens here in the U.S. Now, on our time schedule, the New York is an hour earlier than we are. So here, the bell rang at 8:30 a.m. our time. And it's still running. It's not finished for the day. It will close at 3 o'clock our time. We can see the ones that I usually focus on are the Dow 30. It was down good and solid, definitely bear on the top tier of the economy. The S&P 500 down, well, interestingly, it was down less. Usually it's the opposite. It would be down more, but the 500, the vast majority of the world's value, was down about 0.5%. And then you can go up here and go down here to the NASDAQ, and it took a beating too. In other words, there's no question this was a bearish day. And that's a little scary, because there was some really good news that should have made the market say yay, and instead they said boo hiss to what should have been good news, at least in the short run. The thing, though, is that good news in the short run is very bad news in the long run, and I'll talk about that in a minute here. But anyway, here's something that's interesting. This thing right here, see this VIX, V-I-X? That's not even a stock or an exchange or an index. It is a pure measure of volatility. Now, volatility is another name for risk. In other words, there was a lot more up and down and up and down than usual. Risk scares responsible large investors. They don't like risk. They want risk to be at a minimum. We can't get rid of risk, but we can get rid of a lot of it. And if they are worried about if there's a lot of volatility, that translates into concern for investors. So oftentimes when you'll see the VIX get green, in other words, volatility is accelerating, that is going to be this signal a bear market, or at least a bear day. VIX was showing more volatility, and sure enough, we see that that translated into lower prices of stocks. And again, I'm going to talk about this over and over again so that this becomes baked into your thinking, especially this concept of risk. We don't want risk. We try to find ways not to have risk. And when the risk is coming at us, volatility, in other words, prices becoming more and more unpredictable up and down, that scares us. We want to get out of the way of that. Now come down here for just a minute. We're going to run over here. Look over here at the 10-year bond. Now this is a measure of this one right here. This is a measure of like a benchmark interest rate. That's a yield right there. And we'll talk about bonds later. But it's essentially this 10-year bond is kind of like our way of looking at how all interest rates are performing. And it is though that yield is up. In other words, interest rates are up, which causes slower economic growth. Because when interest rates go up, people don't buy as many cars, businesses don't borrow money for new projects. Employment isn't as good because you don't have all these new projects to hire people for. So the markets don't like bond yields going up. That's a bad sign for the economy. And right now, they are at levels we don't hardly ever see. So this is of concern to us, and it's of concern to you, because when yields go up like this, companies don't plan for tomorrow. They plan for next year or for a couple of years in future. So if they see interest rates going up now, that diminishes their taste for projects that will come to fruition in a year, 2 years. That talks to you directly, because you will be out there looking for jobs in a year or 2 years. So it's something to keep an eye on. And the not just for an investor, but for a person who is interested in where the economy is going from this point in time. Now, I want to come over here. These are, by the way, in the middle column are currencies. One of the courses I teach here is international finance. And the math isn't hard, but it's confusing, really confusing sometimes. But I leave that off until near the end of the semester. These are commodities. And I'm saying some of the same things that I said the last time, and I will do it again and again so that this bakes into you. Is that some of these commodities, for example, silver. Silver is a commodity. It's a physical metal. It is used in industrial and cosmetic items all the time. It's very popular. It is affected almost entirely by supply and demand dynamics of the companies that you and industries that use the metal. That is as opposed to gold. Gold, yes, it is used in industrial processes and in cosmetic products. However, it also has a lot of speculators. Speculators buy gold when they think the economy is going to hell. They sell the gold if they don't think the economy is going to hell. So we keep an eye on it because, yeah, underneath it, there's supply and demand for the commodity, but there's also these people we call gold bugs who are always watching the economy for signs that the apocalypse is about to happen. And as you can see for the day, there was a little bit of a spike. It's up there. During last semester in the spring, it got up to a whopping $5,000 an ounce. Then it fell to about $4,000 an ounce. Actually, it dipped under $4,000, and now it's on its way back up again. So something has got those speculators spooked, and they're running away from stocks and away from bonds and going for the safe harbor of gold. So we keep that in mind. Now, copper is another one that is generally, it's not generally, it's entirely just uses of copper. Copper is generally at historical highs right now, which is bad for industries like housing, where copper is used in pipes, for homes, it's in industry, copper is used for that too, and in other ways. So copper is one that we kind of keep an eye on to see where it is headed. Right now, it's lost a little of its momentum. Okay, now, crude and Brent, and this is something I said before and I'll say it again. Crude oil price is just the overall price of all grades of crude. Now, crude can come in grades from the stuff that when I was in oil and gas, it can go from this what we call thick, heavy, sour crude. I mean, it is heavy because it's just like almost like sludge coming out of the ground. It stinks like the Dickens, and it's just not fun, and it's hot. And that was the stuff that we pulled a lot of out in the patch. But then you get the higher grade, up clear up to one that is a light, sweet crude that we, from the Brent, the oil fields outside of Brent in the North Sea. When I say light, sweet, light, it is very thin. It's easier to break it down into the products we need, like gasoline and all that. It's also sweet. Sweet means it doesn't have sulfur in it, which if it has sulfur, we have to clean that sulfur out before it's worth anything to us. Now, in a very simplistic fashion, when oil is brought to a refinery, it goes into cracking towers, and the cracking tower builds and cracks more and more and more as it goes up the tower. At the top of the tower, 50% is cracked to the grade of gasoline. That's stuff we put in our cars. Now below that, about 25% is cracked to the level of what we call distillates. That would be kerosene, diesel, and jet fuel. And then below that is the lowest level of cracking. That's 25%, maybe about that. Plastics, cosmetics, it goes into things like concrete, you name it. Just all kinds of industrial uses for the part that's sitting down there like sludge at the bottom of the tower. Okay, so we see that Brent will always have a higher price. Well, it should have. I saw it once when it was lower, but Brent will always have a higher price than the average because it's lighter, sweeter, it's easier to crack to the stuff we want. And so in this case, crude and Brent are both on the upswing again. They got as high as more than $100 a barrel when we were having the biggest issues with the gas, with the oil getting through the Strait of Hormuz during the Iran war. We're getting back into some serious problems. They're not as bad as they were before because we do have other places where oil can come through to get out to the ships that ship it to the refineries. But still, we are concerned now that there is another problem that is starting to show up, is that there is not enough crude for all of the demand that we have for crude. And that's beginning to scare us because we're beginning to see shortages that could last over a year, maybe 2 years. Diesel is in really short supply now as far as ability to produce more of it from the towers and all of that kind of stuff. Getting it there, we have these different kinds of tankers. We have the very large dirties, and we call them dirties because they carry crude oil, which is dirty. But they have only a few ports they can get into. Now, the smaller tankers can get into more ports, like, for example, the port at Suez, port at Panama, and other ports like that. So we get it in there, but there's not enough coming through for all of the different types of demand for oil that are out there. Now, another aspect of this, what should the price of oil be? Speaking from the perspective of an oil participant in the oil business years ago, right now I'd say about $80 a barrel is a good price for oil. Well, don't you want it to be as high as possible? Hell no. You see, because when the price of oil starts going up, you have every fool wannabe landman and his brother going out into the patch, getting leases and punching wells. That gluts, eventually that gluts the market with oil and the price of oil collapses. We don't want the price too low because we can't get enough to lease the equipment. We don't get enough so we can pay our own bills as the wildcatters. So there's like a kind of a sweet range. And I'd say it's like about maybe 78 to 82 a barrel is where you would really like to see oil be. It's not so high that you bring in the idiots that are going to eventually glut the market with oil that they've pulled out, they're pulling out of the ground. You don't want it so low that you can't pay your bills with what you're getting out of the ground. So yeah, there is that kind of sweet spot. We're above that sweet spot right now. We're definitely above it. And it will get worse over the next few weeks. You're probably going to see it creeping upward as more and more information comes in about this problem that is looming of this critical supply shortage, especially for diesel. Now, it's not so bad here in the United States, but for the rest of the world, it is going to be quite a thing. So there's sort of a picture of some of these, this world, seeing the financial market and seeing the physical market. And let me take you somewhere else here. This is down here, it's called a sector map. It takes the stocks in by sector and shows you what the stock performance, the average. If you had a portfolio that was only technology stocks, what would it have done today? Well, it would be down a little more than a quarter of a percent. Well, how about the banking sector, financial services? Well, it was down more than a third of a percent. You notice that this is dominated by red. In other words, we have overall a bear market, a bear market, at least for today. Nothing seems, there's a few, energy seems to be up a little bit, surprise, surprise. And there's other things that are up too. However, overall, it's definitely a bear day. Now, does that mean tomorrow's going to be a bear day? Absolutely not, because these are a random walk. The idea that there is something you can tell about tomorrow from yesterday does not apply in stock markets. They are a classic example of a phenomenon all through the universe. And we do it in physics, we deal with it in physics, in chemistry, in all kinds of gaming theory. It's called a Markov chain. The only information about what to do next is from what is there now. Like, for example, a chessboard. You don't need to know anything about how a chessboard got to its current position to know the next move you should make. There is nothing there that can tell you anything. In other words, Markov chains impound all past information in the current value, in the current price, in this case. And so all this looking at historical charts and all that kind of stuff is just over a long period of time not worth your while. You need to look at what is going to happen. That's why one of the problems we have in finance with accounting data is that all of that data is historical. It is brought to financial statements from receipts of things that have already happened. And in finance, that doesn't matter at all to us. So there's one of our big problems with dealing with financial statements. They tell us what was. We have to know what will be for us to have anything to, meaningful to say. Now, the next thing that I want to take you to are some actual stocks and give you some information. And make sure you write this down, and I'll repeat it over and over again for you so that you know this. Now, there's some of this information that is in the textbook, and I have to make a qualification of a couple of things that are said in the textbook. But to start this off, let's step into the high technology world with NVIDIA, NVDA. You notice that it's following the market. It's a bear day for NVIDIA. And you notice that it's been bouncing. See that volatility going on there? You see going up, down, up, down. Okay, take us down. This is the numbers, the panel of numbers that will matter to you. I'll give you screens and I'll ask you to read off the screens what is being told to you. Because in there, these numbers is the whisper of the story of this company itself. The first thing that you look at is right here, the bid and the ask. Now the book talks about this from the perspective of the broker. I teach it to you from the perspective of you and me as the traders. The bid is what you can sell a share of NVIDIA at right now. It's 215. If I wanted to sell a share of NVIDIA, I would get $215 for it. The ask is 218. That's the price you would pay for a share of NVIDIA right now. You might say, now, wait a minute, what's this all about? You mean I don't get as much if I sell it as I have to pay if I buy it? Yeah, that's simple. I, as the broker, need to make scratch. That $3 bid-ask spread there, that's my coin. It's essentially, I'm buying it from people selling it at a lower price, then I'll sell it to someone who wants to buy it. So the bid-ask spread is simply how much I am going to make as the dealer off this stock on one share. Now, the bid-ask spread has some information in it. The narrower it is, the more trading, generally speaking, is happening. When I was a stock, when I had a stock, a penny stock house, if I were getting a whole lot of orders in on a stock, buys and sells, well, then I didn't have to make as much on each trade to make a decent a buck for the day. But if there are not so many trades happening, I'm going to have to spread that margin so I buy at a much lower price than I sell at so I can make a living at it. So oftentimes that bid-ask spread is driven by the level of trading activity. Now, is this a wide or a narrow spread? Well, you got to take into account the we're talking about a $200 stock. We've got a $3 bid-ask spread. Actually, that is kind of wide for today. And you notice, look at this. See the volume? We're almost at the end of the trading day and only 50 million shares have traded. The average day over the last year, 143 million traded. So this was a light day. And so that would explain a little bit, at least, of why the bid-ask spread is pretty wide on this right now. You've just got fewer trades, so the bid-ask spread is going to open up so that we can make some money off this stuff. Now, let me take you here. The market cap is the number of shares outstanding times the price per share. In other words, this is the market's assessment of the value of the ownership of this company. It's $5.246 trillion. Think of that as the market's assessment of what this company is worth. Now, let me try something and get this out of the numbers and talk to you for a little bit here. Madam, how much are you worth? Oh, stop it. That's what Bob said to me. I look in the mirror in the morning and I say, yeah, uh-huh. But realistically, probably about $6 million, okay? You take, not easy there. You take all of us in this room, you take all of us in this city, you take all of us in the country, and one of these companies is worth more than all of us combined. And there are literally hundreds of companies like this, at least certainly dozens. Their value makes us trivial. not even trivial, meaningless, even as an aggregate. When you get to this power in financial terms, you can't tell me that they do not control everything from supply and demand to political and cultural opinions and all of that. And they're just accelerating it forward with the artificial intelligence, which is prompting us now, and it's going to get a lot worse over the next couple of years. They control this world. These values just are beyond our imagination. And so now let's go to one of the most important numbers that I will teach you over and over, and eventually I'll show you the math of it. But by the time you get to the math of it, it's almost like trivial because you'll know what it means. It is this nasty little thing here called beta. Beta is our measure of risk. Now, in most sciences, social and physical, hard sciences and all that, we use the standard deviation as the spread. That's the risk, the volatility. We don't want that one. We want one that's highly specialized, and it's called beta. A beta of zero means that the security would be riskless, has no risk. A beta of one means that the security has the same risk as the world portfolio. In other words, it on average moves exactly like the world does. So between zero and one, you have what we would call conservative or defensive stocks. They're relatively safe. They don't have a lot of volatility. Above one, they are more volatile, riskier than the world portfolio. Now, when you take relative measures, and I'll show you a few here over the next few minutes, a beta above about 1.2, 1.3 means that you as a non-professional should stay TF away from those. Seriously, they are the stuff of heavy risk-taking investors who are able to take major hits for another day for a day down the road that's a win. These are not the kind of appropriate investments, as we say, for the normal investor. NVIDIA is up there in the stratosphere. That's a beta that is absolutely nosebleed. That's one that only real serious risk-loving pros would want to walk into and expect to come out unscathed. Because this goes up. If the world market portfolio goes up by $100, this goes up by more than two times as much. But on the other hand, if the world market portfolio goes down, this stock will go down by two times that amount, more than two times that amount. So this is telling us whether this is something that we really want to play with or not. This is a nasty, this is really nasty, this one is. Now, here's one that's interesting. P-E ratio. And for this one, I'm going to have to give you a little background with an example. You see, there are two values for a company. There's the market value, and then there is something called the intrinsic value. I'm showing you market values here. Now, let me tell you about the difference between these. You, sir, you are my son. I was lonely, okay? Get over it. I know I wasn't there for you. You should be glad for that. But I tell you, I'm looking at you right now, and you had borrowed the car, you come back, and all you have is a steering wheel. The rest of the car is Flinders on the side of the road. You've gotten yourself involved with some pretty shady people, and I've seen you come out of a garage wearing a gas mask a couple of times, and Man, you are such a disappointment to me today. But over, that is a market assessment. Boy, you pissed me off today. But over a long haul, I know damn well that you're going to be something. You're going to make yourself right, and you're going to make a lot of money, and you're going to be a respectable citizen and all of that. That's an intrinsic value. Markets don't measure intrinsic values. If you saw a trade, the trading mania, it's just a bunch of greedy sharks buying and selling, pushing it up and down and up and down. They are not, they don't care a rat's ass about the true underlying intrinsic value of the corporation. Now that is, you could say, well, that's a theoretical value. True enough. But at the same time, you can't tell me that there isn't a true actual value to the corporation. The markets are not going to show you that. All they're going to do is take advantage of information, buy it today, sell it tomorrow, bounce it up and down and up and down. What is the underlying whisper? And that's intrinsic value. Now, how do we do that? Find that intrinsic value. We have different methods, and I'll show you a few here in class, but there's one that's actually pretty darn decent. See that PE ratio? If I see a price to earnings, if I see that price to earnings too high, I know that this, I am pretty sure that the stock is overvalued. If I see it unusually low, I have a good idea that that stock is undervalued. Now, what is high and what is low? You're going to hear different opinions. My fulcrum is 30. A 30 would tell me that the stock is right around intrinsic. If I see it much above 30, I'm saying, that's overvalued. Stay away from it. If I see it much below 30, I say, well, that's undervalued. That might be a buy. So you see here that NVIDIA is a little overvalued right now. Do you see that? A little overvalued. So it's a guidance. It's not an absolute. Don't get me wrong about that. But over a long period of time, we do know that, and actually you look at the industry, not just an overall number, but 30 is kind of like a good place to think about. And in this case, I see that it's a little over 30. Now, a couple of other numbers here that I want to just bring up very quickly. This company actually pays a little lousy dividend of $1 a share. So, in other words, you are hoping the stock will go up in price. But even if it doesn't do well on capital gain, at least I get a check for $1. So, in other words, that kind of is a measure that tells us, that's only about 0.46% of $216, but at least I'm getting something for my $216. So that kind of gives you a sense. Stocks that pay a dividend tend to be a little bit better than stocks, as far as risk goes, than stocks that don't. Now, let me take you to the other side. Let me take you to one like Colgate-Palmolive, CL. And before I even look at the beta, let's talk about the risk of it. Madam, do you use shampoo? You do. Do you use toilet paper? Yeah. And so things like that, basics. Colgate-Palmolive is in, you brush your teeth? Well, yeah, okay. You see, those are basics. Whether the economy is up or down, you're going to brush your teeth. You're going to buy some shampoo. You're going to buy some soap. You're going to buy toilet paper. So these companies that create, that they live off making consumer necessities, I would bet you that those companies are very low risk, quite low risk. And if we look down here, let's run to the beta real quick and have a gander at it, see what it says. The beta, sure enough, look at that. That is a pussycat beta, 0.33. Remember I said zero is riskless? Here we've got one that is just really quiet. And it's because, I mean, they're going to be around come hell or high water. So these, and now understand, that lower risk means you should expect a lower return. But at the same time, at least you're not likely to take a butt bath on the stock. You're not going to have a heart attack seeing the price going up and down violently from day to day. So, and here we go. Look at the PE ratio. Yeah, it's still a little overvalued. So, that's one of those things. It does pay a darn nice dividend. Look at that. Now, remember, we look at percentages. That percentage that pays a check for each share, you get a check for $2.12 in the mail. That is $2.11 is, what is that, about 2.33% of what you pay for it, $90. So in this case, $90, you're going to get 2.33% for it, which is actually better than a lot of savings accounts pay these days. So this is kind of a way to think about this price of the stock. Now, let me take you one more here and see what we can see, try something else here. Oh, here's one. That company that is run by He of the Cloven Hoof, otherwise known as the Baked Ham, Tesla. Look at that risk. Yeah. Well, I'm more buy a Tesla. No, you're not. Don't buy their cars either. Those trucks are ugly ass. But anyway. Okay, bid-ask spread, see, you will buy at the ask $344. If you wanted to sell a share, you'd sell it for $342. You notice something broader here. As soon as you buy a stock, you're already in the hole, because if you wanted to try to sell it immediately, you'd get less than you paid for it. So immediately, as soon as you buy any stock, you're going to be in the hole to the extent of the bid-ask spread. And what you are actually hoping for is that the stock will go up enough to cross the ask that you paid. Always keep that in mind with this. And notice Tesla doesn't even pay a dividend. All you're doing is riding that stock's price appreciation. You don't get a check in the mail. All you have to do is hope that that stock price goes up. And look at the PE ratio. You see that? Remember what I said, where's the fulcrum at 30? Anything above 30 is overvalued. Well, technically, the technical term we say is that this is overvalued AF. That's a technical term. This thing is insanely overvalued. It's probably overvalued by about, literally, if you took this literally, it's probably overvalued by anywhere from 5 to 10 times. The company, think about it from the fundamentals. Remember, a market price is what you are going to pay. That's what they're going to shake you for. That does not mean that's the worth of the company. And in a case like this, the 5 of the top 10 selling cars in the world are Toyota. Only one is a Tesla, and it's a model that they have canceled. So that gives you an idea of the market isn't pure and true. It's not. We're going to get you for whatever we can, and there is so much vested interest of the large Wall Street houses in stock that they bought of Tesla. They aren't going to let that thing fall to intrinsic. They're just going to keep buying and digging themselves a deeper and deeper hole as long as they possibly can. Because if they started selling the stock the way they should with that PE ratio, they would destroy their own houses, because the value of their house would mark to market would be nothing, comparatively speaking. So yeah, you don't think of market prices as something the universe is saying about the truth. It's just what the market has decided it has to do for the time being. Now, when will Tesla find intrinsic? Not for a long, long time. But when it happens, it will happen dramatically. But not today, not tomorrow or this year, or maybe for another decade. Anyway, that is all there is to what I will show you. And every day I will show you different stocks, and I will also show you these animals called ETFs. And the last thing I'll show you on this, on the screens today, you don't have to buy individual stocks. If you were to, you'll see later, to have a good portfolio, you probably should have about 30 stocks in it. That is difficult, first of all, to get by that many on most people's salary. And the other thing is you have to manage it. You have to keep balancing it. You know, the prices change, so the weights change, so you have to bring it back into balance. It's a pain in the butt to do that. You don't have to. There are professional funds that buy portfolios of stock, and then you buy a share of that portfolio. One of those is a classic. It's called a SPYDER, SPY. Now, what SPY is, it's the Standard & Poor's 500. In other words, if you buy a share of SPYDER, you have bought the entire S&P 500. You have, and it's managed by professionals. It's called an electronically traded fund, an ETF. Now, these are expensive. Don't get me wrong, but I'm going to tell you a secret about that. This SPYDER, it is the S&P 500. And so if someone, okay, let's take it this way. You go to a finance singles bar, and someone comes up to you and says, "So, what kind of investments do you do?" "Well, I buy a few shares of this stock and that stock," and you know, you're going to go home lonely. But if you say, "Well, I own the S&P 500," lol, you will go home with a friend. Okay, that's how powerful it is. You own the entire S&P 500. A little tiny, tiny piece of it, but it is a well-diversified portfolio, which is absolutely necessary, and we'll talk about that. And it's all taken care of for you by professional fund managers. And these fund managers, one thing that I'll tell you more about, you always want to look at the, and there are literally tens of thousands of these ETFs. Go. Yeah. If you realize capital gain, you pay tax on it. And that's an unfortunate thing. Of course, if you lose, then it's the negative of that. So it saves you money. So it's not as bad on the downside as it sounds, because even though you lost, you can take that, the capital loss against your tax, other taxes. So yeah, if it goes up and you sell it, then you're dead. You're paying on it. That's why professional, you know, really, really super rich people, they never sell stock. They just accumulate stock. And then what they do is there are banks that will just simply lend them money backed by their stock, and they live on those borrowed funds their whole lives. And then when they hand it over to their heirs, it gets marked to the new basis, no tax there either. So that's how the rich and famous live. They never sell their stock. Even if it goes up and up and up, all they do is just borrow, and then they pay the interest on it year over year over year. They borrow more and more and more. And so in the long run, what that means for you is you've got to be rich. Okay, and then you don't ever have to worry about capital gains taxes, because you never sell the stock. You just borrow money on it. Got it? Yeah, that sort of makes me sad even saying that. Okay, yeah, go ahead. I'll tell you, I'm glad you asked that, because SPYDER isn't the only one. This is State Street's. Now, there are other fund companies that do other ones. And the interesting part about that is that the way I and a lot of professionals look at it is we just go down and we say, they're all doing the same thing. What is their expense ratio? Anything below about 0.1, 0.15 is a good, in other words, that's how much the fund managers take out for themselves. So what I look at is if I want to own S&P 500 ETF, then I get a list of the ones that do that, and then I just find the one that has the lowest expense ratio. That's my, it's kind of a simple rule, but it's a good question you're asking. And this is true, like the NASDAQ, there are ETFs for that entire NASDAQ. One I think is VOO, VOO, or something like that. Yeah, but you look at the ones where they are not, the professionals aren't sucking the fund dry buying their third martini at lunch. That comes down to that, at least in my book. And, you know, there are a few other factors. You know, oftentimes my interest is also in staying with a certain fund family so that if I'm going to do something like another ETF, well, I've got a couple with State Street, so I stay in the State Street family of funds. Just sort of out of a consistency, I don't have to have different platforms and deal with that. Good question, though. Now, let me shift the gears here, and we're going to do this every day, but let me shift the gears here. Just talk for a few minutes about what are we talking about when we talk about businesses and corporations. The first thing that I would point out is that by far the largest number of businesses in the world and throughout now and throughout history have been what are called sole proprietorships. Sole proprietorships. It's just one person, and there really isn't a company. It's just you, and you are all at risk for everything that is done. So in other words, I'll take a good example. You, sir, decide that you are going to mow lawns for rich people. So you buy yourself a nice truck, you buy yourself a nice lawnmower, and you go and you mow these rich people's lawns. One day, without noticing it, you drive over some rich lady's poodle. Expensive poodle. Really expensive. You give that animal a show dog trim. Well, you know what they're going to do? They're going to take your truck, they're going to take your mower, they're going to come into your house, take your family Bible, and sell it on Craigslist, and then they're going to make your parents wear furries for them. Furries aren't a crime, man, okay? You understand? They're going to take you for everything. You. Well, that was my company. No, you. Because there isn't a company. Now, you can give it a fictitious name, and I'll tell you how to do that in a few lectures. But it's still just you. There is no company. When you die, the company is gone. Well, I'm going to give this business to my daughter and son. No, you're not. There is none. You die, the company's gone. Closely allied with that are partnerships, which are the same thing, except it's more than one person. And still, jointly and severally, all at risk. So in other words, if your partner screws up, it's all on you as well. Now I'll tell you how serious this is. I started in my world as a professional artist and photographer. I did on-site shoots and all that, but I also did art exhibitions, and I still do them to this day. But I was a sole proprietor. I had a fictitious name. It was, you know, I did the application, you do it with the state, and it was called Emergent Light Studio. First it was called Digital Imagery by Alan Kring, and then I turned it into Emergent Light Studio. It's just a fictitious name. I am all at risk in this. And that is very bad, you see, because that means anything that happened, I could be taken to the cleaners. There was an art show one year, it was up north of here, near Chicago, and I had all these nice, these racks with these framed pictures, museum glass, all the nice stuff, and I had some on easels. And they were sitting so that when people walked by, they could look and they could see, ah, there's, that's nice. Let me walk in and look at some of the stuff. Well, some kid came flying through, kicked one of the legs of the easel. This huge painting came to the ground, shattered the museum glass all over the place. Well, I mean, then the kid's mother comes in there just having an absolute hissy fit. You could have killed my kid. He could have gotten cut on all this glass. Look at this. I'm going to sue you and all this. You know, I had to maintain my composure. I'm trying to be, diplomatic. I said, look, bitch, you destroy. He did this himself, but I was still all at risk if she had sued me for it. Fortunately, she liked my art, so I gave her a couple of paintings. Anyway, that's how serious it is. So that brings us to this ultimate form of business organization called the corporation. The corporation is a legal entity. It is not its owners. The owners are just stockholders. It absorbs its own liabilities. It makes its own money. And then the owners benefit from that. But do understand that in this kind of a corporation, your debt holders have prior claim to the cash flows. You have to take care of your debt holders first. And then what's left goes to the owners, the stockholders. So in other words, the shareholders have the residual claim, while the debt holders have the prior claim. So you always have to keep that in mind that, yeah, but you see, this is one of the cool things about it. I can tell you a number of stories about how the corporation can be fabulously misused. There's one story. I don't know if you'll recognize it, but I never met the man, but he was rather well known in New York, that he would create a corporation. He would pay himself insane amounts of money as the chief executive officer. He'd borrow tons of money from banks, and then he would essentially drill the corporation into the ground because he sucked as a businessman. But what would happen? The corporation would owe the liabilities, the bond, the debt holders. And he'd just walk away and start a new corporation. And he would leave the debt holders. They couldn't come to him because the debt was the corporations. So he would collect all these big salaries, enrich himself, and then he'd go on to create a new company when he crashed a company. Over and over he did that. And there was not just one. There were many, many of them. And I had personal experience with a few of them, not with the one I was telling you about, though. But, I mean, that's just the way it is. A corporation absorbs the liabilities. And if you're smart, you just pay yourself fabulously until you crater the corporation. That's enough for you today. Go home.